Chapter 28 Technicalities. In early October 1971, Lieutenant Colonel Connie O'Shea arrived at the Phoenix Directorate and was assigned by John Tilton as liaison officer to Colonel Sung at the Fung Hwang Bok office in the National Police Interrogation Center. His job, he told me, was to tell Tilton what Sung was thinking. A veteran intelligence officer who had served in Vietnam in 1966 and 1967, O'Shea described the directorate in late 1971 as Sleepy Hollow. There were ongoing discussions between U.S. and Vietnamese police officials, he recalled, as to how to get the program transferred. Tilton and Operations Chief Paul Coughlin were doing their Freaks Phung Hwang re-examination report, and coming down from Washington was a proposed list of things we should back away from. They were going to turn the dossiers over to the Vietnamese, and the special branch was apprehensive. They didn't want to turn their files over to anybody. The other big thing was PHMIS, Phung Hwang Management Information System, but it was not ready to be used yet by the Vietnamese. Co-authored by the Corps' Research and Analysis Division, Freaks, according to Phoenix Operations Chief Paul Coughlin, came from John Tilton, who initially wanted to call it Phung Hwang Reprise. It involved 4 months of depth research and included slides and graphs, explained Coughlin, and basically outlined how to transfer Phoenix to the Vietnamese and how to deal with lessening assets. In 1972, the directorate had at most 15 staffers. But it also addressed what activities U.S. forces should be involved in and to what degree, the whole idea of Revolutionary Development Support and CORDS, which was the program's Achilles heel because everyone was answering to a different master. Detention was not a Freak's issue, Coughlin added, but military justice and the moral aspects of the program were, as were our concerns over Vietnamese loyalty. After all of these things were considered together, we decided not to let the program die on the vine, but just to let the dead areas go. Otherwise, Coughlin noted, our concern in the directorate was that people in the field got what they needed, jeeps, communications equipment, etc., which we learned about through reports. He added that reports on operations ran up through another channel, through Special Branch. As for the relationship between the Special Branch and Phoenix, Coughlin observed that the directorate was very compartmented, that a reserve officer on staff might have worked for the CIA, and that Chester McCoy's replacement as deputy director, Colonel Herb Allen, was not in the know and was selected for that reason. Coughlin asserted that the Green Beret murder trial changed the whole thing, and that employees of the Defense Investigative Service started arriving, running agents and doing background investigations for Phoenix in 1972. A different perspective on Freaks was provided by Coughlin's deputy, Lieutenant Colonel George Hudman, a veteran intelligence officer who was also a friend of John Tilton's. Coughlin was not an intelligence officer, Hudman explained, and as a result was not trusted by Tilton. So I briefed Freaks to Jake, George Jacobson, and General Forrester. Basically, it explained why Phoenix didn't work. People in the agency were looking for a way to back out, and Freaks was it. We took all the data compiled from all Phoenix centers, put it all together, and showed that the program was failing because it was too big and because the military had no understanding of it. They had no understanding of intelligence. They would round up VCI suspects, and they resorted to body counts. But intelligence isn't predicated on body counts. Despite blaming the military for the failure of Phoenix, Hudman explained that Shackley, then Polgar to Tilton, was the real chain of command, and that Bob Wall, then senior advisor to the Special Branch, oversaw Phoenix. Indeed, as the U.S. military prepared to leave Vietnam, the CIA needed to find a new way of managing the attack against the VCI without appearing to do so. In other words, the concept of an attack against the VCI was still considered vital. What was sought was a new organization. The process began when General Abrams suggested in October that responsibility for the full anti-VCI mission should be assigned to the National Police Command on a time-phased basis commencing 1972, and that Phung Hwang committees and centers be deactivated as a way of increasing the emphasis on the anti-VCI responsibilities of district and province chiefs. These recommendations were studied in Washington by a working group composed of Josiah Bennett, State, John Arthur, AID, George Carver, CIA, John Monopoly, Public Safety, General Carrolls, ISA, the Joint Chiefs of Staff, and SACSA. After each agency had considered the proposals, Bennett shot a telegram, 196060, back to Saigon, indicating tentative approval, although in deference to the CIA, with the special branch collating intelligence and maintaining dossiers on the VCI, and with positive action responsibilities assigned to the PRU, NPFF, and other elements as required. A few weeks later, Ambassador Bunker sent a telegram, 17357, to Secretary of State William Rogers, saying that Robert Thompson and the GVN had also approved of the plan. The working group then prepared to send a team, headed by the Vietnam Task Force's Action Officer, Jack, to Saigon to determine which key people could be reassigned to Phoenix. When the team arrived in Saigon in mid-November, according to Jack, Tilton got the okay from Carver to give me the Phoenix information. Despite its tentative approval of the plan to phase out Phoenix and turn the management of the attack against the VCI over to the National Police Command, NPC, the CIA had no such intentions. In fact, in October 1971, orders went out to all province special branch advisors to begin forming Special Intelligence Force Units, SIFU. Eight-man teams composed of four volunteers each from the Special Police and Field Police, the SIFU were targeted specifically at high-level VCI as substitutes for the PRU. They were also assigned that the CIA planned to manage the attack on the VCI through the special branch, while keeping Phoenix intact as a way of deflecting attention and accountability. For Fujian Province PIC advisor Rob Simmons, who worked undercover of the CORD's Pacification Security Coordination Division, but who never even met the CORD's province senior advisor, Phoenix in 1972 was merely a library of files to cross-check information, not the CIA's partner in the attack on the VCI. "We would go to Phoenix," Simmons told me, "and they'd show us a file, and we'd use the file to build a case. And every report we generated, we sent to the PIOCC. But Special Branch had its own files, and if at the PIC we got someone who cooperated, we would withhold his file, if he was going to be doubled, because we knew the PIOCC was penetrated." Furthermore, according to Simmons, the Fujian Province officer in charge concentrated on unilateral operations and political reporting because he considered, as had Rocky Stone, Special Branch liaison too exposed to be secure. As William Colby explained it, CORD's people were kept out of the station, and even though Special Branch coordinated through the province senior advisor, the station had a clear chain of command in intelligence matters. Indeed, Phoenix was a valuable resource, and it allowed the CIA to say that it had no officers in the districts. But the CIA was not about to turn over its special branch files to the National Police Command, NPC, or submit its agents to NPC authority. And when those proposals returned to Carver's desk for final approval, there they died. In December 1971, Carver wrote a working paper entitled Future U.S. Role in the Phung Hoang Program. Its stated purpose was to ensure that the GVN Phung Hoang program continues to receive effective U.S. advisory support during upcoming 18 to 24-month period with an option for continuance if required. Using familiar terms, Carver defines Phoenix as A. the intelligence effort against the higher levels of the VCI who possess information on enemy plans and intentions. B. the intelligence effort directed against the lowest level of the VCI, who perform an essentially political function of relating the Communist Party mechanism to the population, and C. an action effort to neutralize the targets in A and B. He also notes that on November 27, 1971, General Kiem changed his mind and said that Phung Hoang centers and committees will be retained, that the Central Phung Hoang Committee would be upgraded and chaired by Kiem himself, that the Phoenix program will be continued indefinitely, and that included will be a rewards program funded by the GVN. 1 month after Bunker had killed the high-value rewards program, it was born anew as a GVN program as part of Phung Hoang. The main reason for not scrapping Phoenix, Carver writes, was the crucial need to destroy the VCI. However, he suggests that the titles Phoenix and Phung Hoang Advisor be dropped, and he warns against withdrawing advisors in provinces where the VCI presence was heavy. The minimum staffing level appears to be about 30 positions, which would provide coverage of the program at national, regional, and a few key provincial echelons, Carver writes, adding, "Plans should be drawn up to have the normal U.S. advisory structure absorb anti-VCI advisory duties beyond the transitional period of the drawdown." He envisioned the complete withdrawal of Phoenix advisors by the end of 1972, but only in a way that would provide the United States with a capability to monitor not only the GVN program, but also to develop some semblance of an independent estimative capability. That job would fall, after 1973, to the 500th Military Intelligence Group, as well as the CIA. As ever, the CIA got its way. On December 28, 1971, State Department officer Lars Heidel, in response to Carver's paper, wrote that Feng Huang should be handled by the special branch within the National Police Command, that Feng Huang committees should continue in existence, and that province and district chiefs should assume responsibility, beginning with the most secure areas where there are few RVNAF main forces. Perhaps U.S. military advisors will continue to be needed as long as RVNAF retains action responsibilities for Feng Huang, but as action is transferred to the special branch, the advisory role should be taken over by the special branch advisor, the CIA man, author's emphasis. This is the reprise John Tilton imagined, the return of the special branch to prominence in anti-VCI operations. By 1972, it was policy, as articulated by Bob Wall. I was really pushing Special Branch to support Phoenix during the Easter Offensive, while the VC were overrunning Hue. The National Police Commander, Major General Feng, had the Chief of Police in Hue on the phone. I told him what to do, and he relayed the message. Where the Special Branch contributed, Wall said, was in Hue in April 1972. There was success. As soon as the North Vietnamese Army, NVA, attacked, the VCI in Hue were to begin sabotage and terror attacks within the city, direct NVA artillery fire, and guide assault columns. However, reports Robert Condon, the Phoenix coordinator on the scene, before the enemy agents could be activated, about 1,000 of them, who had been long identified by the PIOCC, were arrested. Our intelligence indicated that the NVA commanders were blind in Hue due to this timely Feng Huang operation. Phoenix, Bob Wall insisted, represented the strategy that could have won the war. But, he lamented, Ted Shackley stuck to the traditional route of only collecting intelligence and gave Phoenix away. Removing the special branch in 1969, Wall contended, kicked the teeth out of the program. The special branch was up to the job, Wall added. Mao had instituted a training program in 1970, but Kiem prevented them from getting good quality people because Mao had demonstrated the operational capabilities necessary to pull off a coup. Not that he was close to trying it, but when Tieu listed the possibilities, Mao was at the top. He was smart, charismatic, courageous, cold-blooded, politically minded, and he had access to the agency and troops who could pull it off. A Catholic and Central Vietnamese with Con Lao connections, Mao was good at his job, but he was a consultant to PA&E, and he had given the CIA access to the accounting records of the special branch, and he had organized his own political party, the Nationalist Students, all of which combined to make him a liability. So after Tieu had won re-election in October 1971, Mao was replaced as chief of the special branch by Brigadier General Hoin Toi Te. Colonel Song was replaced as the Chief of Phoenix by Nguyen Van Giao, and General Phong was replaced as the Director General of the National Police by CIO Chief Nguyen Cac Binh, even though, according to Tom Pulger, it was a mistake to have one man in both positions. Pulger added that Rod Landreth and Phil Potter negotiated the transfer of Phoenix and the PRU to the GVN with Generals Binh and Dang Van Quang. Meanwhile, the CIA was distancing itself from the PRU. Three Corps advisor Rudy Enders noted that PRU National Commander Major Nguyen Van Lang was fired for selling positions and shaking down his region commanders, and that, by the time 1972 rolls around, Ho Chau Ton, former commander of the 8th Airborne Battalion at Tan Son Nhut, had taken over in Saigon. Michael Drosnan quotes Ho Chau Ton as saying, "The main mission of PRU was assassination. I received orders from the Phoenix office, the Vietnamese and Americans there, to assassinate high-level VCI. We worked closely with Saigon with the CIA from the embassy and in the provinces with the CIA at the consulates to decide who to kill." Writes Drosnan, "Tuan offered to name names of high-level Americans who directly ordered assassination strikes, but then he backed off. I have enough experience in this profession to be afraid," he explained. "I know the CIA. I might be killed." New Times, 1975. In 1972, the PRU were advised in 1 Corps by Patry Loomis, in 2 Corps by Jack Carroll and Bob Gallardo, in 3 Corps by Rudy Enders and Felix Rodriguez, and in 4 Corps by John Morrison and Gary Maddox. Phoenix operations in the field in 1972 varied from region to region. Rudy Enders told me he had the VCI on the run in 3 Corps, and in 4 Corps, where the PRU were most active, success was reported against the VCI. But in 1 Corps and 2 Corps, where the NVA concentrated its attacks in 1972, the situation was much harder to handle. Quang Tri fell in April, and in early May the NVA captured Quang Nai City, which it held until September. In Binh Dinh Province, 40,000 Koreans refused to fight, several thousand unpaid ARVN soldiers threw down their rifles and ran away, and the NVA seized 3 district capitals. With the ARVN and territorial forces in retreat, Tieu turned to Phoenix. In May 1972, writes Michael Clare, Tieu declared martial law and launched a savage attack on the remaining pockets of neutralism in the big cities. Government forces reportedly cordoned off entire districts in Hue, Da Nang, and Saigon, and arrested everyone on the police blacklists. The reputable Far Eastern Economic Review reported on July 8, 1972, that 50,000 people had been arrested throughout Vietnam during the first 2 months of the offensive, and Time magazine reported on 10 July that arrests were continuing at a rate of 14,000 per month. For an eyewitness account of Phoenix operations in 2 Corps in 1972, we turn first to Lieutenant Colonel Connie O'Shea, who in January 1972 was transferred from Saigon to Phoenix headquarters in Nha Trang as deputy to 2 Corps Phoenix Coordinator Colonel Lou Millett. The problem with the program, according to O'Shea, was that people were being rotated out, but replacements were not being made. And as the intelligence officers went home, the Phoenix guy took over that job, but not the reverse. It was a one-way street, and Phoenix fell to the wayside. Millett was trying to keep Phoenix people doing their Phoenix job, O'Shea continued, and he spent a lot of time going around to the province chiefs, trying to keep them focused on the VCI. But it was hard during the spring offensive, so Millett and Region 2 Phung Hoang Chief Dum went around trying to keep the organization in place, telling the Phoenix coordinators that if they had to do S2 work, not to forget their anti-VCI job. That was number one. Our other job was making ourselves visible with Colonel Dum so the Vietnamese would not get the sense that we were pulling out. We kept a high profile. We were missing a couple of province guys, and an awful lot of DIOCCs were missing advisors. The district senior advisors were not taking over, but were trying to get the Vietnamese to take over. So we spent a lot of time touring and helping the Phung Hoang committees and DIOCCs collect intelligence and prepare operational plans. Thirdly, O'Shea said, Millett was an operator, trying to conduct as many missions as possible himself. Millett's biggest success was turning the Mountain Guard battalion that had led the attack on Hue during Tet of 1968. 52 years old in 1972, Medal of Honor winner Lou Millett, who in 1961 had helped create the Vietnamese Rangers and later did likewise in Laos, was known as a wild man who participated in ambushes and raids against VCI camps with Connie O'Shea and some of the more aggressive Phoenix coordinators. According to Millett, Phoenix was coordinated at Corps level by the CIA, and I had to backchannel to get around them. According to O'Shea, the Phoenix program had gotten to the point where the region officer was a manager's office. Millett was trying to coordinate provinces and districts, and where we did run operations, it was in a province where the PIOCC was not doing much. We, as senior officers, did not theoretically coordinate with the CIA's province officer in charge. That was the job of the major at the PIOCC. One such major at a PIOCC in 1972 was Stan Fulcher, the Phoenix coordinator in Binh Dinh Province. Stan had taken over all the programs, O'Shea noted. He was running the whole show. He kept taking on everything, including the PRU, which was true in many cases. The son of an Air Force officer, Stan Fulcher, was brought up in various military posts around the world, but he brands as hypocritical the closed society into which he was born. The military sees itself as the conqueror of the world, Fulcher sighed. But the military is socialism in its purest form. People in the military lead a life of privilege in which the state meets each and every one of their needs. Having served in the Special Security Unit at Kan Tho Air Base in 1968, where he led a unit of 40 riflemen against the VCI, Fulcher fully understood the realities of Vietnam. He told me of the military security service killing a Jesuit priest who advocated land reform, of GVN officials trading with the National Liberation Front while trying to destroy religious sects, and of the tremendous U.S. cartels, RMK, BRG, Sealand, Holiday Inns, Pan Am, Bechtel, and Vinel, that prospered from the war. The military has the political power and the means of production, Fulcher explained, and so it enjoys all the benefits of society. Well, it was the same thing in Vietnam, where the U.S. military and a small number of politicians supported the Vietnamese Catholic establishment against the masses. Greedy Americans, Fulcher contended, were the cause of the war. The supply-side economists, these are the emergent groups during Vietnam. During a tour in London from 1968 to 1971, in which he saw British businessmen trading with the North Vietnamese, Fulcher learned there are no permanent allies. During his tour in Phoenix, he became totally disenchanted. "When I arrived in Saigon," he recalled, "an Air America plane was waiting and took me to Nha Trang. That night I talked with Millet. The next day I got in a chopper and went to Quy Nhon, the capital city of Binh Dinh Province, where I met the S2, Gary Hacker, who took me to my quarters in a hotel by the ocean. Hacker then took Fulcher to meet the province senior advisor, a young political appointee who lived in a beautiful house on the ocean. When I walked into the room, he was standing there with his arms around two Vietnamese girls. The tops of their ao yais were down, and he was cupping their breasts." Next, Fulcher met Larry Jackson, the CIA province officer in Binh Dinh. Jackson had about 20 contract workers, USIS types, who thought they were special forces. They all had Vietnamese girlfriends and important dads. They were all somewhat deranged and did nothing but play volleyball all day. Fulcher described the Corps' advisory team as a sieve. As the Binh Dinh Province Phoenix coordinator, Stan Fulcher supervised nearly 1,000 U.S. technicians and Vietnamese nationals, including a special forces sergeant who ran Binh Dinh's PRU. The PRU advisor reported both to the CIA and to Fulcher. "His Vietnamese wife had been cut open," Fulcher said. "He was a dangerous man who went out by himself and killed VC left and right." Fulcher mistrusted the PRU because they did not take orders and because they played him against the CIA. Fulcher's Vietnamese counterpart was MS Major Nguyen Van Vinh. "The Vietnamese with the MSS," Fulcher contended, "were the worst. They kept track of what the Americans were doing. They had friends in the VCI, and they would deal with Phoenix before the police. The National Police had its own advisor, a former cop from Virginia who ran the field police. The pick was terribly disgusting. And there was an interrogation center behind the province operations center," Fulcher said, "right behind the province senior advisor's house. Our barracks were next door." Mr. Vinh was paid by Fulcher, who also had an interpreter and seven other Vietnamese on his Phoenix staff. "I could influence each one," he stated, noting that with no replacements coming in, the advisory vacuum was easily filled by an aggressive person such as he. "As more and more Americans left," Fulcher explained, "more Vietnamese came under my control. They needed consolidation. The structure was so corrupt with everyone power-grabbing that independent units couldn't do a job, and that meant added jobs for me." For example, Fulcher inherited Binh Dinh's civic action program, including the 59-man RD teams, which had been getting $1 million annually in U.S. aid. "Then the well dried up and funds were cut off," Fulcher explained, "which caused much bitterness. Like the Contras, or before them the Cubans, everyone was turning against the government." As the province Cywar officer, Fulcher also controlled the Quy Nhon TV station, where he spent one day a week working with the actors and staff, organizing parades, producing broadcasts and puppet shows, printing leaflets and distributing radios tuned to the GVN station. According to Fulcher, the embittered Vietnamese Cywar officer absconded with the TV money and sold the radios on the black market. Fulcher also managed the Chu Hoi program. "During the spring offensive," he recalled, "we gave them rifles and sent them up to the front lines. I sat on top of a knoll and watched while they threw down their guns and ran away." Territorial security was a job that involved checking villages every 2 weeks for a day or so. The territorial forces, he pointed out, were a motley crew, mostly old men and women and little kids. Fulcher also liaisoned with a Korean White Horse Division, which would steal anything it could get its hands on. According to Fulcher, Americans were involved with the Koreans in drug dealing, and he said that the Koreans were sadistic and corrupt. In explaining the meaning of Phoenix, Stan Fulcher said, "You can't understand it by creating a web. There were several lines of communication which skipped echelons, and I could go to whatever side, military or Phoenix, that I wanted to. Phoenix was more of a political program, like what the Germans had on the Eastern Front, Gestapo SS, but half-assed. For that reason, Fulcher explained, the regular military didn't like Phoenix, and the province senior advisors, PSAs, hated it too. Twice a week, I'd brief the PSA at the TOC, Tactical Operations Center. Each member of the province team would brief through his deputy. The operations officer was the main guy, then the G2, then Phoenix, PRU, and the CIA rep. The province Fung Huang committee met twice a month, at which point the MSS would exercise whatever influence it had with the province chief, who'd say, "We need 50 VCI this week." Then the special branch would go out and get old ladies and little kids and take them to the pick. They'd send us on special operations missions into the hamlets, and the village chiefs would take the old and maimed and give them to us as VCI. If you don't give me rice, you're VCI. It was perverted. The ARVN supplied us with cards on everyone they didn't like, Fulcher went on, but we could never find them. On night operations during curfew hours, we'd seal off the exits and go after a specific guy. We'd be running through houses, one guy lifting up a lamp, another guy holding pictures of the suspect and taking fingerprints. But everyone had the same name, so we'd search for weapons, maps, documents. It was just impossible, Fulcher sighed. So, after 2 months, I started to find ways to let people go, to get their names off the list. You see, Bingding had something like 37 political parties, and no one could say who was VC. By 1972, most district chiefs were NLF, and even though they were appointed by Saigon, most were from the north and were kept off hit lists due to friendships. What finally convinced Fulcher to work against Phoenix was the disappearing of 30,000 civilians in the aftermath of the spring offensive. Rocking back and forth in his chair, his head buried in his hands, sobbing, Fulcher described what happened. Two NVA regiments hit Bingding in the north, mainly at Hoi An. We went through a pass in the valley to meet them, but a whole ARVN regiment was destroyed. 400 were killed and 1,600 escaped down Highway 31. I could see the ARVN soldiers running away and the NVA soldiers running after them, shooting them in the back of their heads with pistols so as not to waste ammunition. I could see our helicopters being shot down. We called in close air support and long-range artillery and stopped them at Fumi. There were pitched battles. The NVA attacked on two ridges. Then II Corps Commander John Van was killed up in Kon Tum, and Special Forces Colonel Michael Healy took over. Healy came in with his Sherman-esque tactics in August. The disappearance of the 30,000 occurred over a two-month period beginning in June, Fulcher said, mainly through roundups like in the Ukraine. The MSS was putting people in camps around Lane Field outside Quinon or in the PIC. Everyone was turning against the GVN, and anyone born in Bingding was considered VC. There were milis by the score, from aerial bombardments and artillery. Phoenix coordinated it. Me and Jackson and four or five of his contractors. The National Police had lists of people. Out of the 30,000, the special branch was interested in particular in about 100. The MSS put everyone else in camps, and the Vietnamese Air Force loaded them up, flew away, and came back empty. They dumped whole families into the Gulf of Tonkin. This was not happening elsewhere. How could this happen? You're a shadow, Fulcher explained, his face contorted with anguish. You're a bureaucrat. You only think things, so you don't investigate. After the disappearances, Fulcher complained to a State Department officer. As a result, two things happened. First, in addition to his job as Province Phoenix Coordinator, Fulcher was made senior advisor in the three districts, Hoi An, Hoi An, and Binh Khe, that the NVA had seized. Next, an attempt was made on his life. Jackson was unhappy with the PRU, Fulcher explained. He couldn't pay them anymore, so they moved in with the Binh Khe district team. I was scheduled to go up there to pay them from the Intelligence Contingency Fund, but a West Pointer, Major Pelton, the Phoenix guy from Phucat, went instead. And the PRU shot him in the helicopter right after it landed. Pelton was killed, and the Phucat District Senior Advisor Colonel Rose was wounded. The incident was blamed on the VC, but Mr. Ving and I went to the landing zone and found Swedish K-rounds, which only the PRU used, in the chopper. First I went to the PSA, then Millet at Nha Trang, then Healy in Pleiku, but nothing ever happened. In explaining how such tensions might occur, Connie O'Shea, who replaced Lou Millet as II Corps Phoenix coordinator in August 1972, points to the inclusion of key military leaders as well as civilians in the definition of VCI. Van put pressure on to get these guys, O'Shea explained, but Special Branch would not give their names for security reasons, and as a result, military advisors started going after the COMO liaison links, those VCI that were more military than political. And when you got very strong personalities like Stan Fulcher in there, that situation became explosive. Stan wanted access, and his solution, O'Shea said, was to force it back up to Van or Healy, who would say, "I can't force them to open up files." So it was kept at the local level, where it went back and forth between Stan and Jackson. And I had to go down there and try to mediate between them. But we just had to accept that this was not the period of time to be arguing with the CIA that to run an effective PIOCC we had to have their dossiers. The time to do that was 4 years prior, but Stan was insisting that he was going to get at them. Well, the CIA would give other stuff, revolutionary development or census grievance, but not Special Branch. When asked why he and Millet could not exert influence, O'Shea replied, "This is why Phoenix was not as effective as it should have been." In March 1972, Ambassador Bunker sent a telegram, 040611Z, to the State Department saying, "We question whether the USG should concede failure of an UNTREE system to meet test of Article 3. Because he thought that UNTREE probably did violate the Geneva Conventions, Bunker asked that a decision be put off until completion of a study written by CORD's legal advisor Ray Myers. In the study, entitled UNTREE Observations and Recommendations, Myers suggested, among other things, opening UNTREE hearings to the public. On April 11th, John Tilton advised against doing that, saying it would result in the compromise of sources. Under Executive Order 10460, Tilton wrote, the American public is not allowed to attend U.S. administrative security proceedings, nor are transcripts of the proceedings releasable to the public. It is difficult to justify why a nation which is seriously threatened by internal subversion should institute a procedure that is not even allowed in a nation which has no such threat. Tilton's recommendation on this point was accepted. Myers also noted that the great majority of the Vietnamese people are completely ignorant of the purposes, procedures, and results of either Phung Hoang or UNTREE. Tilton retorted that that was a subjective statement and could cause a reader with little background to reach the erroneous conclusion that the programs were pretty much of a failure. Tilton recommended that many be substituted for great majority. That suggestion, too, was implemented. On April 12th, the CORD's Public Safety Directorate added its 2 cents, calling UNTREE a relaxation of the RVN's right of self-defense and a gratuity. The embassy recommended that detentions based on a charge of belonging to or supporting the VCI, a crime of status, be eliminated on a province-by-province basis over a period of years to eliminate gradually the whole UNTREE structure instead of institutionalizing it by transferring jurisdiction over VCI from the province security committees to the courts. However, Tilton advised against the province-by-province phase-out, and his position again was accepted. Faced with intractable CIA internal security considerations, the embassy decided to defer reform of UNTREE indefinitely. But it did not want to appear to be sanctioning summary executions either, so embassy police officer Stephen Winship emphasized that the mission recognizes this to be a serious problem, particularly when excessive legalism or considerations of public relations are introduced, tempting the police to neutralize by killing instead of arrest and prosecution. It was suggested that the computer system at the National Identity and Record Center be supported and that some provision be made for the review of cases where VCI suspects were released by the province security committees. The idea was to set up a central control that would prevent abuses at the local level and would allow the GVN to market preventive detention as a substitute for killing people. The result was that UNTREE was to be reformed into a system not of sentencing, but of indefinite detention, with periodic review by the Central Security Committee. It was to apply only to communists. This system was to be a temporary measure, which offers possibilities for avoiding possible criticism under the terms of the Geneva Convention. Article 19 of Decree Law 004 of 1966 was amended to preclude charges that the system violates Article 7(2) of the RVN Constitution, and Bunker put the U.S. seal of approval on Entree. While the subject of Entree was being debated in Saigon, Four Corps Commander Trung in Kanto authorized, on April 21, 1972, a special F-6 Fung Hwang campaign designed to neutralize the VCI by moving against suspects with only one adverse report on the record. A response to the Easter Offensive, the F-6 campaign was started in Chaodok Province on the initiative of the province chief, who was concerned with the reports that NVA units were being guided and assisted by the VCI. More than 1,000 VCI suspects were quickly rounded up. Flying as it did in the face of Entree reforms, F-6 was the cause of some concern. Mission is aware of potential pitfalls in Special Fung Hwang campaign and possibilities of adverse publicity if campaign used for mass roundups of suspects, wrote Ambassador Bunker. 125 Phoenix advisors were left in Vietnam in October 1972 when a tentative agreement was reached calling for the formation of a National Council for Reconciliation and Concord composed of representatives from the GVN, NLF, and Third Force Neutralists. On October 24th, President Chu presented 69 amendments to the agreement and, stating that the VCI must be wiped out quickly and mercilessly, ordered a new wave of arrests. On November 25, 1972, 3 weeks after Richard Nixon was re-elected, Chu signed Decree Law 020, Concerning National Security and Public Order. Issued in secret, 020 modified Entree to the extent, Ambassador Bunker wrote, that these powers are no longer limited to wartime and may be applied following a ceasefire and the end of an officially declared state of war. The evident purpose of the law is to provide an extension of Entree procedures in preparation for a ceasefire confrontation with the communists. Broadening Entree to include people deemed dangerous to public order, Bunker wrote, means that virtually any person arrested in South Vietnam can now be held on criminal instead of political charges. The public order provision was included in Decree Law 020 precisely because the ceasefire agreement prohibited the incarceration of political prisoners. According to Decree Law 020, communist offenders already in jail under the Entree laws would also have their sentences automatically extended. Likewise, province security committees were directed to extend automatically the detention of categories A and B VCI until the end of the present emergency, which did not end with the ceasefire. As a result of Decree Law 020, thousands of Vietnamese remained incarcerated until April 1975. On December 18, 1972, Newsweek estimated that there were 45,000 official prisoners in Vietnamese prisons and another 100,000 in detention camps. Amnesty International reported at least 200,000 political prisoners, and other observers cited higher estimates. The U.S. Embassy identified on its computer tapes fewer than 10,000 political prisoners and called the criticism unfounded in light of Entree reforms. In Saigon, 3,000 people were arrested in one night. The cost of having an enemy's name placed on a Phoenix hit list, now easier than ever thanks to Decree 020, was reduced to $6. In December 1972, ceasefire talks collapsed and Nixon bombed Hanoi. Chu called for a return to the denunciation of communists' campaign of 1956 and ordered his security officers to target neutralists at the National Council of Reconciliation and Concord. With Decree Law 020 safely in place, Prime Minister Kiem canceled the F-6 campaign and ordered a return to the three-source rule. However, wrote Bunker, there is some evidence that the National Police do not regard the order as terminating the accelerated Phung Hoang campaign. By 1973, South Vietnam had come full circle. Only the names had changed. Empowered by secret decrees written by CIA officers, security forces now arrested dissidents for violating the public order instead of the national security. In March 1972, Prime Minister Kim determined that it is important not to get hung up on the term Phung Hoang. The problem that the Phung Hoang structure was erected to address will still remain with or without the term. In a report on Phoenix, Phung Hoang Effectiveness During August and September 1972, John Tilton crossed out the words Phung Hoang and inserted in their place the term anti-terrorist, explicitly heralding the modern era of low-intensity warfare. In Natrang in December 1972, Connie O'Shea transferred the records and equipment in the Region Phung Hoang office to the public safety advisor, who didn't want them. "Then I turned off the lights," he said, "locked the door, walked across the street to the Cords building, and turned in the key."